Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:46 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 19th. Well, I thought I would kick off with West Texas Intermediate because it's up $2.54, and this could be a higher reaction low. Now, if we get some upside follow through, then that would certainly look like a more convincing signal. So what happens over the balance of the week is going to be important. But President Biden came out today and said something rather important. And this is a great example of how politicians really don't understand how markets work. So he basically said that there's still 400 million barrels in the strategic reserve, and they're going to release some more, and they're going to keep doing releases until December. So now they're not going to end in October, which is what was originally thought of, and they're going to keep going because they want to try and get prices down. And in normal circumstances, that'd be fine. But then they come out and say, well, you know what, lads, we're going to start buying it back at $70. So the price today is at 85. And if you're a bullish trader, well, you know that the government is going to start buying at 70. And to refill the strategic reserve, that's going to be hundreds of millions of barrels. So that's a lot of demand that's sitting out there potentially ready to buy. Now, this is the dilemma that the USA is in. As an energy exporter, they have a clear interest in having higher prices. But then you have the political liability of high prices impacting the domestic market. So what they're really trying to do is encourage companies to have two prices, have less profitability on their domestic operations, so that the politically palatable lower prices will be available, and then have higher prices for the international market. Now, countries like Mexico achieve that by having price controls, and they take the profits from the state-owned energy company, and they ensure that prices domestically can't rise. What I found also especially interesting is that Mexico's hacienda hedge was announced yesterday, and they've hedged out their supply for 2023 at $68. So there is certainly some correlation between the US hedge at 70 and Mexico's hedge at 68. Now, if you're a leveraged trader and you can accept a $15 risk, well, then it's in your interest to buy. And if you're a producer, well, then it's in your interest to produce because you've got a guaranteed price from the government that you'll definitely get $70. And of course, then if you're OPEC and you see non-OPEC members boosting supply and governments intervening to try and support the price, well, you might decide on the one hand to massively increase supply, but that would be politically palatable for lots of consumers. What you might also do is give them enough rope to hang themselves and decide that you're not going to produce as much. Allow the hedge that the US government has promised to work and let them pay $70 and keep the price there. OPEC enjoys the largesse, doesn't have to increase supply. And when they eventually run out of money, which is not an unrealistic possibility, then OPEC will have a lot more control of the market. So there's really a lot going on in here. But upside follow-through this week would give us some indication that the normal course of events when politicians interfere in the price setting mechanism will follow through, which is that they get exactly the opposite of what they intended. Now, then we can think about what's happening with Brookfield Asset Management. Now, There's a couple of things that are worth highlighting. The first is Brookfield is the most successful share in Canada over the last few years, and it's coming down rather heavily. Now, there is a tendency among these successful Canadian companies that in order for a Canadian company to raise the capital, build the business, expand into the US market, then expand internationally, then it takes time. And we've seen several occasions over the last 20 years when a Canadian company has really turned into an absolute world beater. And that has generally coincided with the peak in the market. So Nortel Networks was really a world beater, comparable to Cisco Systems, and it no longer exists. And then you had the BlackBerry, which was the go-to semi-smartphone before the iPhone arrived. Then we had Shopify, and Shopify was unreservedly the incredible success story of the post GFC or global financial crisis world. So the price went from about $3 to 200 in the space of 10 years. And since then, it's fallen from 200 to 40 or 38 and change in here today. So this is really quite an extraordinary decline. Of course, relative to the size of the move on the upside originally, then it's doesn't look like much on the log scale chart, but this is really a massive crash. So then let's think about bond yields. And the assumption that there's a wall of cash ready to come to the rescue. 10-year yields are up to 4.12%. So that's a big pop on the upside in here, 12 basis points just today. And there's no question it's an accelerated trend. But there's the world of difference between a trend that's been going on for years that it then accelerates and the breakout from a base formation. And I think that there's no real argument that this lengthy range below 3% from 2011 all the way through until 2022 was a big base formation. We had the failed downside break in 2020, the rebound back to the upper side of the range, and now a really impressive breakout. Now, if we zoom in, well, it's still a consistent trend. We have a sequence of ranges one above another, and the 3.5% level held. And then we've had this pause just below the psychological 4% level, and now it's breaking out. Now, there's a tendency to think that when you see a 5% yield on Apple, on an Apple bond maturing in 2045, that's got to be value because the dividend yield is less than 1%. But investment grade debt is only trading at about 100 basis points over treasuries, and treasury yields are accelerating higher. So there's certainly been a lot of cash raised because prices have been falling and people have been selling, and they have to do something with that cash. And certainly investment funds, they that need to be invested, well, they have to buy something. So it's there's certainly a rationale behind the fact that the higher yields go, the more attractive they're going to be from an institutional investor's perspective. But that doesn't mean that we're at the bottom. I think it's important to highlight that credit and tends to lead stock markets. Now, the high yield debt is up to the spread is up to about 544 basis points. And in absolute terms, we're into double digits. But in just spread terms, which is, and it's important to remember that bonds are a relative value market. So it doesn't matter that the absolute yield is in double digits because inflation is running at the high single digits. So then let's just look at this long-term spread. And it really does help to highlight that the further back we go, the more efficacy the view is that it rallies up to between about 750 and 1,000 basis points represent lows in the market. And the level that we're at right now is not sufficiently high to encourage the cash that is on the sidelines back in. Now, one of the rationales for thinking that this is a time to buy is that there's a lot of money on the sideline. So I'm highlighting this fact about private equity dry powder in here today. So McKinsey wrote a report in April of 2021 saying that there was $1.4 trillion in dry powder. And PitchBook today is estimating that the dry powder is more like 300 billion. Well, there's a trillion-dollar discrepancy in that in those two figures. What it suggests is that perhaps there's not quite as much dry powder on the sidelines from private equity. So then we know that there's a lot of money that's been parked in repo. And that figure is up into over about 2.5 trillion. Now, that money has come out of the bond market. People are looking for the shortest possible duration they can get, and that's repo. So it's overnight. And they're parking their money there until yields start to come back down and the pace of interest rate hikes stops going up and starts coming down. Then you're going to get a wonderful buying opportunity in fixed income. There's going to be double-digit spreads available on high yield. That could be a nominal yield somewhere around 15 or 16%. Then there's going to be a probably 200 or even 300 basis point differential on the investment grade market. It's only 100 basis points right now, and treasuries will be yielding somewhere around 6 or 7%. And that's going to compensate people for some of the risk from inflation staying higher for longer. But we're just not there yet. Then, when we look at the stock market, yes, it has come back a lot, but it's been an exceptionally orderly pullback because we have not seen a big spike in volatility. And I've highlighted the fact that there's this triangular pattern forming right now in the VIX. So we have higher reaction lows and lower rally highs. And these types of triangular patterns give way to explosive breakouts. And considering the trajectory of liquidity and interest rates, then it's reasonable to anticipate that those breaks are going to be on the upside. So it's also worth highlighting that if the more back history we look at, the more efficacy we have, that it's when the VIX gets up to somewhere around 50, then that's a buying opportunity. And it usually coincides with lows in the market. And we're just not there yet. So that suggests that we have to be prepared for additional downside. Now, I created this chart in here today, and it's looking at the expense of interest payments relative to GDP. So it trended higher from the 1950s all the way through until 1980, and the big acceleration occurred between about 1976 and 1986. Then it leveled out. And this obviously coincided with a major recession, really significant inflationary problems, then fiscal consolidation. Eventually, inflation did start coming down. Growth took off. It helped to overwhelm the interest expense, and then GDP really took off. So the finances of the government improved, where they weren't spending 5% of their budget on interest payments, and now it's at about 2.37%. So this is a halving over the course of the last 30 years in how much the US government has been spending on interest expense. So GDP has still been rising. And when we move into a recession, then yields will probably come down. And obviously, the speed with which spending is contained will be a big impact. But if spending is not contained, well, then the cost of servicing the debt is going to rise. Now, it's important to highlight that this is very much a lagging indicator, and the figures that are reported are quarterly in arrears. So what we're really looking at here is the data from the beginning of the year. And it's going to be March of next year before we even get an idea of what it looks like now. But the trend is certainly going up, and it looks like a failed downside break. So that 12 months from now, we could easily be at 3%. And we're coming off of a lower base, excuse me, a higher base than we were in the 1960s. But then the potential is that this is going to become problematic. It's not problematic immediately, just like the VIX index is not a problem now, but it's not about whether things are problematic today. But we have to be aware of where the risks are potentially going to arise in future. So high yield spreads rising and interest expense rising, and then the VIX index breaking out. Those would all be accompanied by significant stress in prices. And there's certainly a lot of money sloshing around. And let me see if I can find this. I did get an interesting letter in the post today, and I thought it was rather interesting because when we think about liquidity, well, it's not every day that hedge funds embark upon direct mail asking for cash. So I've been invited, and I guess everyone else on my block has been invited to a lovely dinner at Ocean Prime, which is a rather nice steak and seafood restaurant not so far away. And they do mention that if you're in the financial industry, do them the professional courtesy of not accepting. But what they're pitching is to provide institutional level investment opportunities to investors. And it's a hedge fund based in Ohio that is literally going door to door asking for cash. So there's certainly a lot of interest in trying to garner as much money as possible. And there's still a huge amount of money sloshing around. Into that environment, how is it possible for central banks to stop raising interest rates? So I do think that these kinds of events, and I guess I've said many times in the past that I don't think of my own life as being particularly special, but that when I see these kinds of events, I generally take them as almost serendipitous to provide some insight into where we are in the cycle, and this is looking really frothy. So then let's just think about the stock market. And The NASDAQ is basically unchanged in here. And there is certainly a willingness to buy in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And that has been the best place to buy on several occasions over the course of the last 20 years. But we're below the 1,000-day moving average. And we haven't done that since 2009. So this is a major trend inconsistency. And we have a sequence of ranges, one below the last. We have resistance being encountered in the region of the 200-day moving average on several occasions. And then we can think about the fact that value is outperforming growth. So I'm going to just put this chart up. Hopefully it will work. So value has now broken out of its base on a relative basis relative to growth. That suggests that real world cash flows are now more important than the promise of capital appreciation. And I think that's a really significant change. It does suggest that value strategies are going to be the go-to investment strategy coming out of this crisis. But since this crisis has not yet bottomed, then it's still a bit early to jump in unless one has a lot of tolerance for prices to go down before they come back up again. Now, the dollar remains firm at present because the Federal Reserve is still raising interest rates, and the US economy has not rolled over, and unemployment has not risen. So, there hasn't been fiscal discipline enforced upon the US government just yet. But that is coming. But until the dollar rolls over, then gold is likely to remain under pressure. And it was in negative territory again in here today, so coming now down into the region of the low from late September. Silver prices are right in the region of $18, and we're a little weaker in here as well. So this is a potential area of support, or at least it has been, on several occasions since July, but we will certainly need to see a clear upward dynamic. Platinum prices are also a little weaker in here today and rolling over around the $900 area. Until we see a clear peak for the dollar, then it's, I think, quite likely that we're going to see additional weakness coming through in the precious metals sector. And of course, there is then the additional point that the Chinese economy is quite weak, and China's a major buyer of gold. But if people are being locked down, then they're not out buying gold. And the CSI 300 was in negative territory in here today. So a really short-term bounce ahead of Xi Jinping being confirmed for his third term in office. And there's certainly the possibility that we will get government action to support prices, but we're not seeing a lot of evidence for that in the short term. Then the Hang Seng index has been trending downwards for 2 years and was down another 400 points in here today. So now we're right at the lower side of this very long-term range, but not a lot of evidence to suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I continue to see news about investments in renewable energy, and there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm for that. Tesla is steadying from the region of its lows and the 1,000-day moving average, but it's got to do more than that. And it's certainly got to push back above the 200-day moving average in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But then the wider EV sector is under a lot of pressure. Lucid Group despite the fact that it has a big brother in the form of the Saudi government, or the Saudi fund is still trending downwards, and there's a clear sign, there's a clear sequence of lower rally highs. I do think that Brookfield is a canary in the coal mine, because alternative assets have been the go-to for the vast majority of pension funds, endowments, and sovereign wealth funds over the course of the last decade. Now we have office occupancy rates that are around 40%. And this is for major cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York. So people are not going back to the office. Now, ultra prime real estate will always be desirable, but less ultra prime real estate is not going to be as desirable. And what you get in every major property contraction is not so much that all property goes down together, but that the fringes go down most. So it's the second tier cities. And it's the fringes of the central business districts will be experience the most selling pressure. And Brookfield Asset Management has made its name from being an astute investor in commercial property. But with these exceptionally low occupancy rates, and then the significant underperformance of the IPO sector, which suggests that you're not going to have the pipeline of new companies expanding and wanting to go, take on more floor space. If IPOs are underperforming like this, they're going to be cutting staff. And we've seen thousands, tens of thousands of technology staff fired in the Bay Area so far this year. So this is a serious problem, because what's going to happen is leases are going to expire. Those buildings are going to be given back to the investors, which are endowments and pension funds. And then when they want to lease them again, they're going to have to accept lower leases, less favorable terms, and the value of those buildings is going to go down. Then what about mark to market? Will they have to market lower? Or will they have to sell other assets in order to make up the hole in their asset pool? So what's happening in commercial real estate has the potential to have a significant knock-on effect. And that is most particularly true if those buildings were bought on leverage. So we've certainly seen that the banking sector has come through with earnings that are positive because of their net interest income. But the rebounds have been rather muted in terms of the stock price, because there are significant risks. JP Morgan has set aside an extra billion for defaults. And there's an assumption that default rates are going to be similar to what we've had in the last 5 years. But the last 5 years have been a boom. And it's normal. And on top of that, during the pandemic, there was a moratorium on defaults. So, assuming that there's going to be very low defaults indefinitely seems to be a rather unlikely scenario. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.